just a few words about how you grew up. What was a large town, a small town, a little bit of your background.
It's a small town, I guess you'd say. Bloomfield, New Jersey, was bordered on Passaic and Clifton.
Okay.
Middle class, uninspiring, disappointing. Went to art school to put me in a different place, space.
For high school or for college?
College. I went to Camp Ramah for 6 years.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So that was saved my life, basically. I mean, because it gave me a forum and a community and a culture that I could, you know, appreciate and fit into, as opposed to the secular New Jersey suburban emptiness and disappointment.
And your father and your mother, they were working classical jobs. What was
father was a sound engineer for PBS Channel 13.
Interesting. Okay.
And my mother was, I guess, a housewife. She had jobs here and there, but she wasn't like a co-professional working person. You know, she got involved with different organizations and worked with them for a few years and changed her organization, but nothing too settled, so to speak.
Interesting. And when you were growing up, you said there was the boredom. It was boredom with disappointment.
It was just a very mundane, uninspiring, uninteresting suburban lifestyle that didn't really explore culture the way I would want to, or even just its approach to Judaism was, to me, just sort of mundane. And I mean, it was the 60s, so a lot of people were exploring different ways to go about it creatively to expand Judaism, but I didn't feel that it was feeding. I mean, it did feed me as a 16-year-old, you know, it was exciting, but I felt that somehow there was something really missing for me in that, and it didn't make me want to stick to the Jewish thing. So the art was sort of a spiritual stepping stone into something a little more exciting and inspiring and interesting. And then I found in the art world that did not satisfy me so much.
How did you, well, what age did you become involved in art?
Let's say 16.
16 years old?
Yeah, I gave up ice hockey and went into art.
So you graduated at 22 from university with an art degree. What specialty did you have in terms of, was there a specific style that you loved painting in?
Well, my major was drawing.
Okay.
I felt that was the basis of all visual art, and I felt that I needed to understand that and have as much skill and familiarity with it as possible to go on to something more individual. And I went to Europe, and anybody who was interested in art stayed in the States and went to graduate school, you know, master's degrees in art. They weren't even interested in traveling. They were pretty set in their American culture, I guess.
What was the importance of travel for you? Why did you decide?
Well, I need to open up my mind. I need to open up my experience. I want to see more things, more cultures, more lifestyles, people.
Was there a formative experience you had during those travels before you got to Israel? Was there a formative experience that, you know, you go back to? Or you say, well, that was really meaningful for me, or inspires you in your work today, or an individual maybe you met during those travels?
I met individuals that, you know, what you do meet when you travel. Nothing to really report on, but the contrast of the people I met when I came to Israel was great. In other words, I met nice individuals, meaningful conversations or relationships that I made, but nothing sort of touched me to my core or to my soul. And when I came to Israel, I met a lot of people that spoke very deeply to me. And I found when I was in yeshiva that...
Which yeshiva, by the way?
Well, I started Eish HaTor a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And then Or Sameach for a couple of years, and then Chappelle's.
Wow. So this is in the 70s.
76, I started at Aish, and then 77 through 79 was Or Sameach, and then 79 through 72 or 3 was Chappelle's.
Wow, okay.
Half days, I was never a full day kind of guy.
Okay, very wise.
Well, I had to paint, you know, I mean, I just couldn't just sit, I can't sit and learn all day long, I just don't have the capability. So anyway, I met people that were very inspiring to me, and I felt had tremendous insight into life and into art. You know, kept me very involved and focused, and affect my life till today. The people I met, you know, here.
So, who is the first person you met when you got to Israel that really made an impact on you? Like, who was the one that brought you to?
Well, it was Meir Schuster through someone I had bumped into at the hotel that I met in Egypt. I spent a couple of weeks with in Egypt, a Jewish guy that we happened to become friends in Egypt, and, you know, before we came here. We just happened to bump into each other here. And Meir had spoken to him earlier. And then he said, "Here, this guy might want to go with you for Shabbos dinner." So,
what was the thing that you said you were made you open to going to a Shabbat dinner to a total stranger? Was that just part of that?
Well, I was familiar with Shabbos from my upbringing. You know, it wasn't like a strange thing. But here I was traveling in a place I didn't know anybody. And someone wants to invite me to their home for dinner, it's not going to say no.
Right.
I mean, I went to other people's houses that I didn't know in other countries. And
then from that, somebody introduced you to Rav Noach?
Well, the way he got me there, and also Orson Mirkas, he said, "We'll give you a studio if you come and learn."
So interesting.
So that's sort of like seduced me, or wow, tricked me, or whatever you want to call
whatever.
It.
Whatever.
Yeah. So I was there for a couple of years when I was single, and then when we first got married, we lived there in the studio for 6 months, and we moved to a separate apartment, and I kept my studio in Bukhara.
Sounds like your relationship with money is you use only what you need.
I didn't have any, you know what I mean? And I knew I might not have. So if I had some money saved up, so I lived on that, and I lived extremely frugally.
What does it mean, extremely frugally?
It means, like, nothing. Like, you know, the bare essentials, brown rice and lentils, that kind of
for years up. You would do that?
Well, yeah, for a few years I did that.
You're amazing.
And, I mean, I was a romantic artist. What can I say?
You know, how many years would you say financially was a struggle? Like, we're talking about no savings. That's what we're talking about. Can you paint a picture of what your bank account looks like for those years? Like, what does it look like?
Well, bank account was always in minus. Regularly getting calls from the bank that they're going to, you know, bounce my checks or this or that. Couldn't pay bills sometimes. You know, water got shut off. Electricity got set down. Had to borrow money. Went to debt more.
And what age are we talking about? Like, until?
Let's say I'm financially sort of stable the past 10 years, let's say. Been relatively, you know, unpressured. It doesn't mean large, but it means that not pituach lumi didn't come in the past 10 years to take out my carpets because I couldn't pay my my bill or something like that, which they had done, you know, or wanted to do. That was just the way it is, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, most people can't understand that, but I just accepted that. My wife, thank God, was understanding that this is the way it is and it's going to be okay.
What kept you going? Like, were you seeing that? Because of so many people, it's the money that's the motivation. But for you, was the creating? That was what was the driving force? It was the creating?
I used to really love creating a lot. It was like, really, that was my hair. That was what made me want to live, in a way. It's such a thrill just to make art. I mean, I really used to like it. It's different now. Not that I don't like it, but it's not so pure or so desperate to create now. I feel a little more relaxed about it. I don't feel the pressure. I felt like I had to prove myself. I felt like I wanted to make it. I felt that I had to want to, you know, prove my, you know, that's what I, that was what was going on as a young person.
Can you tell me a little bit about the business of art? In your mind, when you said, "I want to make it as an artist," what does that look like making? Did you have a picture of what making it looks like?
Well, I wanted, you know, recognition. I wanted sales. I wanted acceptance. I wanted admiration, I guess. When you talk about peers, I didn't have any peers. I've been shunned, always was, and still am shunned by the art world. They don't like what I do. But there are people that do like what I do, so I can make a living. I figured out early, besides private clients and patrons, that a way to make money was through fundraising. So I would partner with organizations to make art exhibitions and get them to invite people and get them to do all the promotion. And then give them, you know, a healthy percentage. But it got me into their fundraising circle of people. Yeah. Which gave me greater renown, which was, you know, in retrospect, very smart.
So it's Itzhak Molly, who...
Mulik, yeah.
So I met him at a patron's home where my company catered in San Mateo. That's how he and I met.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So So the model that you found success with was partnering with either organizations or individuals to do a traveling exhibition, or was always
no,
in
it was
Israel?
Just, it was, well, I did go to the States, but I did do a fundraiser there that was very successful, Dor Sameach.
Oh, you did? Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they invited me, which was nice. I didn't ask them to do it.
Wow.
Because they, in a way, you know, they used me to like say, "Oh, we have professional artists in our student body."
Sure.
You know, look at this guy. But here I was, like, in a room of 500 rich people, and you know, like, you know, 10 of those people realized what I did, and I sold a bunch of paintings in one night. We lived from sale to sale. You know, I'd sell a water car for $300. Wow, we have $300. You know, we can pay the rent for 3 months, and we can eat for a month, and you know, like, great. You know, just hope for the best, and within that time, that money lasted, that we'd get another sale. Sometimes, obviously, we didn't. And I had a little sort of business of making covers for benchers and wedding invitations using my own art.
Wow.
So I learned about printing and, you know, that kind of...
How beautiful. So it was a custom printing business for people who request, you know, I want 100 of this, so it'll be...
Yeah, so I go, you know, I go print it and get it stapled onto their venture, and again, I got paid for it. I got paid for advertising, and I got more exposure.
How does a monetary value get attached to art?
For me, it started when I was in art school, and the Stella contestant that I worked in, it turned out the owner was an art collector. I didn't know that. He just said he was some nice guy, a simple person, actually, and he once brought me to his house and he showed me his art collection. So he was...
So when you were in college?
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I ended up working, I'm going to be graduating, so he said, I'd like to come to your studio, see if there's anything I like. So I went to one of my teachers, and I said, how do you price your work? Like, how do I know what to charge? She said, never sell a drawing for under $75. So I said, and she said, well, use that as a guideline. It didn't dumb much, did it? So the guy came, and... he was a sort of a large piece that he liked, and he asked me how much it was, and I said $300. He said, what did you say? So I said $300. He says, oh, I wasn't sure what you said. Okay, because I thought he was trying to, you know, Jew me down, but he didn't hear me, so I just said $300. He says, okay, and then how much is that one? So it was a much smaller piece, so I said $100. So he said, okay, I'll take them both, you know, something like that. Like, I had $400. That was a lot of money, and I just made, you know, like that. And I thought, wow, this is a great way to make a living. You know, you paint your paintings and you sell them. My father said, he says, when you sell it, it's great, but when you don't, you're not selling, there's nothing. So just be aware of that. But, you know, but I saw that when you do sell, you do make money. So anyway, from that point on, that was my guideline for where to start in pricing my work. I got to Yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva wanted one of my pieces. It was a small piece, so I said $100. He paid it, you know. So I felt my way through that. And then just over the years, I just sort of guessed of how much a piece was worth from that. And then over the years, raising my prices because I thought the work was better or more unique, and more regular work would be cheaper, more special work or larger work would be more expensive. And
did you ever sell prints as well besides adventure?
I would say... yeah, I did. Actually, I started printing right around the time I got married. I started posters and sort of lithos and stuff like that. And that is really what's kept me alive, is the print business, especially during the crash, because people could afford a few $100 print pieces of, you know, $1,000 pieces, $10,000 pieces of whatever. So that's very good. And I still, this day, I'm getting orders online for prints.
In art, the pricing model is A, you felt that how many of the pieces are out there. Two is the complexity of the piece. Three is your own gut intuition as well, which is, it seems like how much value you believe the piece has. And then the clients, from the client's perspective, what do you think they see in terms of when they're buying these paintings?
Look, sometimes they pay and sometimes they don't pay. Sometimes it's too expensive, or sometimes more they want to spend. Or some pieces I think are really unique and they might be very large, and I ask for a unique large amount of money. And sometimes they pay it. So that gives me a certain guideline as to what my work is worth in the market for a person of my age, renown, experience, whatever I am. You know, there are artists that make a lot more money than I do. You know, I'm not internationally famous in the art market, so I don't get those kind of prices. I get, you know, relatively healthy amounts of money for what I do when I sell them.
How did you find your patrons? How did they find you?
David, he was actually teaching a course at NCSY. And a tefillah, and a friend of mine went to it, and he said, this guy, this young rabbi, he's teaching this course in tefillah, it's really amazing. And he's learning all this stuff, it's all this Zohar, da, da, da. He said, I've been YouTube for years, and this guy's teaching me new stuff about tefillah, why don't you come? So okay, I went, it turned out to be David Aaron. So it was a great class, as usual. And afterwards, he said, look, you know, a long time ago, you said you wanted to set up an institute for Torah and arts. I have an institute right now for Torah, and I want to bring art into it. I have a group. It's going to be here, and I want to make this, what's a 3-week program? Called Art Israelite. Oh. It'll be 3 days a week, and you'll come teach and do whatever you want, and I'll give you this amount of money. Do you want to do it? I said, okay. And made a nice brochure. Anyway, this one guy in the class happened to bring his brother and I think two of his sons, and we hit it off, and we got along really well. And at the end of the course, he said, let's come to your studio. Yeah. So he came to my studio with a friend of his. And between the two of them, they bought about 10 pieces.
Wow.
Which is really quite amazing. Then about a year later, he wrote me this letter. So he has this great idea of this project of painting all the parshas.
Right.
Would I do that? So we worked out an agreement and we did it. So he was like my first real patron. Where I was like, had work for a good year and a half, you know, and made some decent money.
One more thing about just the business end of it. Essentially, these individuals became so in love with your work, they'd say, I want to have you recurring work from you, that you'll provide for me or for my home or for my friends, and there's a certain monthly amount that I'm going to be, you know, commissioned from you. So those people become kind of the baseline of individuals that are constantly.
Unfortunately, I didn't have a lot of those in my life.
Not yet.
I just had someone, I'm just finishing up with the last couple ones, who ordered 10 paintings, large paintings. That's basically been keeping me financed for the past 2 years, like decently.
Wow.
Because there were 10 large pieces, and you know, they were good pieces, so it was a fair amount of money.
Wow.
So that was a great gig, so to speak, and I hope we get more.
And in terms of...
But I also get people that don't hire for commission. They just come here and they say, I like that painting. How much is it? And they buy, hopefully.
Is most of the clients that come to you, you've developed through word of mouth or through other form of educating the public about what you do?
Everything. Mostly word of mouth, but I was painting the Parsha Shavua for the Jerusalem Post for 3 years. So every week in the Week of Magazine, I had my painting there. My name was there. My website was there. Was online every week. Chabad did it also, so I got their whole network. Eshet Torah uses my Parsha paintings, so that's a lot of exposure. You know, I do get a lot of exposure, and I've a number of articles have written about me, and now this film is a little bit helpful. That kind of stuff, I mean, whatever, you know? People's homes, people see it, they want to know, you know, where they get it. Can they go to my studio, get letters? People all around the world come to me.
Who are the type of people who are buying? How would you identify your have you identified your target audience? Like, this is the ideal person that will appreciate.
Well, there are a lot of ideal people, but my main body of buyers tend to be modern Orthodox, educated, sophisticated people that obviously have the means to buy and have a cultured, spiritual, intellectual Torah view. That's my work speaks to them. You know, we're on the same language, the same level, the same line of communication. Most of the people that come here are really, really nice people. I just love the people that come here. And I guess because they respond so strongly to my work, so we have this sort of similar place in the universe of how we see and feel, I guess. But now I have a whole new audience in the Far East, which is very, very exciting. An exhibition right now in Taiwan. There's a huge group of people that are in love with Israel and Judaism. And this guy that happens to be an art collector found out about me from a Chinese friend of his that was introduced to me that bought something. And he's basically promoting my work in Taiwan. And the first exhibition was extended. They're going to have two more now in the next few months at other places, which is very exciting. And hopefully there'll be sales from that. And we'll know more about China. We have somebody else doing something there. Because, you know, there's 130 million Christians in China.
Wow.
That's a lot of people. I figure if I sell one postcard for $1 to every Chinese Christian, I'd retire.
I think you'll be okay.
So we're hoping.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, when you look at a particular painting, like say over here, this hupa. I mean, imagine that's a hupa. That's,
yeah.
Like, what is happening when you look at a blank canvas? How did you get from there to this?
Well, most of my paintings start by just pure intuition and desire to express something which I don't really know what it is. It's just an energy, a gut feeling of just, I want to express. You know, it's only what's sing in the shower. What's the motivation? They just sing, I guess, right? In the shower, right? They hum. When they're cooking, people express themselves sometimes when they're feeling good, right? Or feeling bad or angry or whatever people feel. So for me, for the artistic expression, it's just a matter of just wanting to take out whatever that is and put it onto canvas.
The movie.
Yeah.
There's a theme I think I was trying to draw, the artist was trying to draw out, was a sense of you not dwelling on the loss. That was one of the things that I think for him it was important to tell that story.
Yeah.
Maybe the contrast between you and your wife about how she related to it, how you related to it, and your ability to see, you know, 40 years of creativity, or at that time maybe 35 years of creativity.
No, 40 years.
You know,
more actually, because I had stuff from the States I brought, but anyway.
It's 40 years of creativity, and if you would just think about it, I'll say this is also your...
It was a big monetary loss. My kids lost things. My grandchildren don't get their inheritance. You know, those stuff put away. There was major series of work of the Parshas that I did for 3 years. It was going to be a traveling exhibition. It was
gone. Your whole just inventory.
Yeah, my whole inventory.
Your whole inventory, right? Yeah. And then it just before we some details I was curious about was the place insured?
No, most artists don't have insurance.
They're not obligated to have insurance, or...
Obligated?
No,
it's your problem, buddy. You know, you have to have house insurance. If you want, you have house insurance. If you don't want, don't have.
Okay.
You know, if you want health insurance, you know, you're stupid if you don't, but...
Right.
You know, but you know, you're not required by... Well, the only insurance I know about, at least in this country, is you're required to have car insurance for other passengers.
Right.
So I have no insurance.
So there's no insurance on this here?
Nothing.
And because it was a terrorist attack, it wasn't covered under other forms of...
It was not a terrorist attack. It was a mistake by the police that set up a flare looking for terrorists, and it had been seen by cameras, aerial cameras. They came over, they shot a flare, and it went into a tree and lit up the whole place. But the government, for reasons of financial... as well as for, you know, to say it's a terrorist, it's very good, like the terrorists were attacking us, right? So they kept that story, and they had to pay less money out for a terrorist act rather than a government, you know, faux pas, or fashla. You know,
really?
You know what I mean? And I had to sign a paper. I did get some money. I didn't get a whole lot of money, but I got some money, and I had to sign a paper that I had no more claims, and I accepted this was the official report of the government.
Even though you knew it was something else.
Yeah, we knew it was something else. But it didn't matter to me because I was starting to get anything.
Yeah.
I didn't get a whole lot of money. And in the end, I had to pay 50% of that tax. Can you imagine?
That was considered to be income?
It was considered income.
So the compensation you received for the damages of your inventory, they basically purchased...
Yeah, and for nothing. Yeah, purchased for nothing. And then 6 months later, said, oh, by the way, it's 50% tax. And then a few months later, the Americans said, well, you had capital gains tax. You owe us $20,000, you know. Like, so it was pretty, you know, ridiculous what I ended up with getting. But I was able to build a studio and get myself going again. And that's all I really
wanted. Now, are you Ba'am here? Or
Now I'm Ba'am. Yeah.
Because of the self-employment tax.
Yeah, yeah. It's only 2 years, 3 years of doing that because I was paying all this money in Social Security. I just couldn't afford.
It was Stanford. Got it. Okay.
So, it was killing me. So right. I'm glad I'm a bomb now. Yeah.
Got it. And then, so, I mean, such an Israeli, this is one of the things that the stories about the Israeli bureaucracy or the Israeli process is really fascinating, right? So it's, we'll declare this in order so the PR looks better and also so we can pay out less. And then, of course, we're going to have to tax you on the money that we're paying.
Yeah, out. Yeah, that was a killer. The tax was like, whoa. It was...
Some people might watch that movie and say, this person, is like, he's not mourning his loss. There's something, you know, emotionally removed about that experience. How can he not cry? How can he not yell? How can he not be, like, so much? Like, is this person... And then your response was really fascinating. It's like, well, this is the world I live in, right? I don't want to live in your world.
Oh, yeah.
With your subjective understanding of how I need to mourn.
Uh-huh.
Can you just open up? Because I thought that was, to me, was the most powerful part of the whole movie, was the saying, like, the world expects this from me, but I don't need to live by the world's, you know, laws in this way.
Yeah.
How did you get the strength to do that? Was it just natural?
It's just an attitude I have. I don't, you know, I'm not attached to anything, really. I appreciate what I have. You know, when the fire was coming, I thought, you know, well, here's, you know, God is doing this thing, so we'll see what happens. You know, it's like war. War could be any minute. We all know that in this country, right? The whole place can go up. There's going to be bombs, you know. You got Iran, you got Syria, you got the whole world ready to, you know. So I'm ready for it. You know, I don't want it to happen, but if it does, there's nothing I can do about it. I can pray, you know, I can go hide, but it's not going to change anything. So if it comes, it comes, and that's part of the scheme of things. And it's going to be okay, folks. It's going to be okay. Whatever it is going
to
be.
Is that something you had specific tools and exercises to get you to that place of non-attachment?
No, I was in art school once and doing crazy things that people do, and I sort of like passed out, fell on an art project I had been working on. You know, had a little too much, and I sort of like just fell on this sculpture I've been making and I've been working on for days, and I got up, I go, wow. Okay, now what am I going to do with that, you know? And I started dipping these pieces of wood into colored pieces of paint, just re-putting it back together in a different way. Like, I just took the pieces and made art out of that.
Hmm.
You know, I'm not going to cry about the thing that I broke, because it's broken. What am I going to be, a crybaby? I broke my little sculpture? I mean, well, I'll make something cool. I'll make it fun. I'll make it nice. I'll make it, you know. So that's just, that's 50 years ago, I guess, or whatever it is, 40 years. 50 years ago. So my attitude is just to go with the flow, just go with how they are. You know, your kids do certain things. Amazing. You know?
Yeah, huh? You're incredible.
Well, I don't know about that, but I would suggest that people adapt that kind of approach, because it just makes your life a lot less painful to just accept what is, and to use what's there and to enjoy what's there.
There's so many divorces with entrepreneurs. Right. There's so much.
Oh, not just entrepreneurs. There's divorces everywhere.
Divorce is so prevalent, especially coming in San Francisco. We just got to a place where we just don't marry. Right. That's like just, or having children is just living. That's even a higher level of risk. So, how would you say this? What were the keys that you can? Because there's something that came through the movie, which is there's clearly a bond between the two of you. There's something here that's really unique and special. Is there something that you feel like you could share with us, that some tools that the two of you guys practiced, even during the challenging times?
Yeah, you know what it is? You know how you stay married? Stay married. That's how you stay married. Stay married. That's what it is.
Right, it's
you
like
don't get divorced. That's how you stay married.
It's really a commitment. You know, like, you have your ups, you have your downs. And, you know, you, when things are down, they're down. And then, you know, you try to work it out. Right? Like, you know, communication, I think trying to hear what the other person is feeling and thinking. Yeah, just sticking it out.
The best thing I heard recently was just amazing. It said, I did not marry my wife or my spouse because I love her. I love them because I married her.
I think
that's why I love her. She's my wife. I married her, so I actively try to love her and stay married to her because she's my wife.
I think also when things are like in a Torah context, right? And you have like Amona, and you're learning, and you're actively involved with Torah. There's a lot of tools and wisdom that you get that, you know, help you in your own self-development and help you in your marriage also, right? I think for us it helped a lot. Yeah.
You have to be home for Shabbos. You have to be with your family. I mean,
if you would advise potential artists, young artists in Israel or Olim for artists, is there something that if you're teaching a master class and say, this is the book that I'd like you to read, or this is the lecture to listen to, or this is a teacher they need to be aware of, what do artists need to learn? Olim artists.
I don't think there's a difference between an Olim artist or Jewish or not Jewish. In theory, I think the most important thing, and it's not even an artist, it's any person, is to be true to yourself. To be honest with yourself, to be honest with other people, and to do what you believe with full conviction and not compromise and hang in there. I believe in experimentation. I believe in making mistakes. I believe in trying again, trying a different way. I believe in trying to have a good time, doing all those things.
Yeah.
You know? Learning to embrace the mistakes and embrace those hard times. And a lot of times, the hard times for me in art cause me to break through into something better. You know, frustration can be a very good thing. Because you got to break out. It's crossing the Red Sea, basically.
Yeah.
You got to cross the Red Sea all the time. And don't be afraid, as they say.
Another question is, how should artists look at money? What's the relationship between idealism and money? How has your idea about money matured from being a college student to now?
I'm the most financially stable I've ever been in my life at this point. I had a lot of hard challenges. You know, if you don't sell a painting for a month, 2 months, 3 months, okay. But when it comes with 4 or 5 or 8 months, where you don't sell anything, there's no income at all. That's really hard, you know. You got to keep borrowing, you know. Can't lose the faith. What can I say? You know, you can give up, and then you give up. You don't give up, and you hang in there. And eventually, the sale does come. You know, what really was hard, or a little bit, was like, I remember, I was like 8 months, hadn't sold anything. And finally somebody came to the studio and they bought like a fair amount of money, you know, stuff that was like 3 months of a living. And I thought, why, I made all this money? And I thought, but I'm still 5 months behind. You know what I mean? Like, here I just made all this money, but I'm still in debt. I still like have to make it up. But, you know, I just see that you go up and down. And so thank God the past few years, things have been a little more stable. You know, the fire was helpful, got me some renown and some interest in work and things like that. And I got some nice commissions. Money is an important factor and it's very helpful and enjoyable. But that can't be the motivation for, you know, creating something honest, I don't think.
When you were in school, you were trained in probably classical drawing or... This is a very unique style. How did you find your style? Because now you have themes, right? These are all themes that are pretty... They're consistent themes.
I mean, you don't do realism. No, I don't do realism. I work in series. But I was trained classically in the sense of drawing from life and copying masters and that kind of stuff. But... there's also a very strong emphasis on experimentation and different techniques and different methods to paint, to draw, as well as conceptual art and all kinds of other ways to make art or express, you know, oneself. I remember whereas in Bukhara, I'd be changing my style every other day. I'd be like, oh, I'm really into black and white ink drawings now. Oh, I'm really into Chinese approach. Oh, no, I'm really into abstract expressionist now. No, I'm into like still life. Like, I just keep changing, experimenting, did everything. And whatever came to me, I just went with it. And it wasn't even so long ago, a few years ago, I said to my wife, God, I'm going out of my mind. I have all these paintings, A lot of them aren't finished, and I want to start more paintings. And it's such a balagan. There's so much all over the place. She says, that's your process. Somehow it seems to be working, so just do it. You know what I mean? And that, in a way, was very liberating for me. Because I was like sort of eating, it was eating away at me, like, why do I have so many unfinished paintings? Why have I so many things going on and I'm not concentrated and making things more, concrete? And then she may realize that is my process, is to experiment and to not worry about finishing and not worrying about selling this or that, just to go about the exploration. And thank God it works. And I do make the sales occasionally.
I think it's
it's
personally incredible. If there was an opportunity for you to share like one billboard on Beit Meir that everybody could see, like with a message, what would be that message? Do you think like I want people to internalize? What's this thing that is a heritage that you want your people to internalize?
Ayin Tov.
Ayin Tov.
I think so.
That's it.
Sorry.
And for you, and Ayin Tov is, again, the ability to see the positive of any given situation.
Yeah, to look at people that way also. Every situation, just see the good part of it. It's just not worth being a negative, as far as I'm concerned. It just doesn't pay. It just doesn't satisfy. It's just, I don't want to be that way. I grew up that way. I grew up in a world that way. So I don't want that negativity. It's a waste.